I'd like to encourage everyone to once again bring body and mind together with all the running around and changing places and the expected storm that's not coming and all kinds of situations. It's, I think, a very good point, especially for those who are on the beginning stages of learning how to meditate. Since this is the first segment of the annual retreat, it is oriented primarily for people who are beginning to explore the path of meditation and contemplation. This world and through civilizations has been blessed with tremendous, numerous kinds of traditional paths and various newer paths of contemplation and reflection, spiritual paths, profound philosophies. And perhaps it is the through the confluence of all these various traditions that human beings have been able to function in a more or less civilized way, bringing progress, bringing development, that each day that we all live in this world, this existence, each individual, if one takes time to ponder on one's own everyday mental movements, and how many times this mental movement creates a continuum, repeatedly, sort of all the neuroses, the continuum of neuroses that repeatedly originate. If one reflects upon it, and then one expands that to, let's say, all the people in this world, 7 billion, repeatedly generating such neuroses as oneself does. Same kind of hope, same kind of fear, same kind of apprehension, same kind of expectation. That still all of the 7 billion and not counting the other trillions of different kinds of beings that are there with similar kind of grosser or sort of subtle emotions, some able to express them, some maybe not able to express them, but doesn't mean that they don't feel it. And so that, if one takes time to think about, then one understands the kind of chaos that is being projected constantly by all the beings, by all the sentient beings. Now, despite that, what is being projected, what will seemingly look like a explosion of kind of neurosis, of chaos, despite that, that we do have some semblance of civilized, orderly way of living, that each day passes into the next day without creating that much of an havoc. That itself is astoundingly surprising, isn't it? So occasionally when certain difficult situations arises, whether it is natural disasters, but mainly created by beings, such as terrorism, for example, and it is very unfortunate when hundreds or thousands or even dozens of people die out of violence and hatred and discrimination and so forth. Norway has just experienced that. United States has had a long experience. I come from a country where it's an everyday experience. But nevertheless, those that impact, those unfortunate situations that impact our mind so much that we stop to actually think of how human hatred and anger could create so much violence, positively looked at it, is reflection of this, what we are talking about, is that we still find absolute aggression surprising. That every day can pass without that kind of an occurrence. And such an occurrence happens only so, sort of, sometimes, that it shocks the mind. And so, from that, what we begin to appreciate is how much goodness there actually is. That the badness and the evilness still surprises us. In terms of comparison, we are overwhelmed with all the negative emotions. And especially as meditators, you are orienting your mind to becoming very acutely aware of all the negativities that have to be eliminated. Sometimes, for meditators, that affects psychologically. And instead of the transformation, the basic goodness, the power of awareness that will bring about the transformation, one becomes so very sort of, I guess that's the overwhelming feeling. Overwhelmed and stricken by the enormous quantity or numerous continuum and ceaseless production of neuroses, negativities, because that's what you are highlighting. And since the highlighting is constant, there comes a picture in your mind where you think more badness is there, more negativities are there, more confusions are there. When that is not properly observed and translated, cynicism does come out, and you become very cynical of the world that you live in. Sometimes that cynical, which if tamed can become critical analysis, if untamed it becomes cynicism. So the cynicism sometimes highlights more the negativities rather than the positivities. So it's very important to know that you as a meditator is orienting, coaching yourself, teaching yourself to be very acutely aware of all the deceptions, particularly at a very subtle level. So since the mind is oriented towards being very acutely aware of subtle functionings of the mind, it is a fact that yes, the mind is neurotic. The basis of it is so very familiar with a neurotic pattern and responding to the neurotic impulses. But the core quality of the mind, which is good, and it is good because it's very easy to locate the goodness in that, that there is more affinity towards something good that's predominant. Such as even your anger is so that you can feel good. The selfishness is harbored so that you can feel good, so that you can find happiness. It's a natural inclination primarily to have goodness, to feel goodness. Yes, of course, it is sort of warped in kind of a negative flavor of self-grasping. But even the self-grasping is so that you can find your happiness in that self-grasping. Since the natural inclination of the mind is oriented towards positivity, an experience of goodness, an experience of happiness, therefore, since the natural inclination seems to be towards a much more positive experience, therefore the basis is said to be more positive, more good. There is no natural inclination to suffering. You don't say, I am going to be very unkind so that I can really have the pain and the suffering and have terrible consequences. You don't do that. Whatever negative emotions we do project, it is mainly to safeguard some form of happiness. Therefore, all sentient beings want happiness, do not want suffering. It's not talking about a kind of a superficial surface, on the surface kind of a want, but it is much more pointing to a branch that could not have been produced if the root itself was not based upon something good and sort of akin or inclination to a goodness. Now, since that goodness is the very basis, therefore, however, the pathway that it takes in expressing its want for happiness may be wrong oftentimes. So those are the discursivenesses. So the discursivenesses, yes, it is there. But a meditator must never lose sight of the basic fundamental goodness. If that is lost, then the dominating and the sort of continuity of many different neuroses that as a meditator you develop a subtle awareness of will become very daunting, will become very, very powerful, and it will bring in a certain kind of a veil of cynicism, and that can again backfire or misfire and more sort of kill the joy of mindfulness, of awareness. So having a much more objective way of looking at both basic goodness, but the sort of mistake, misconception, or what we simply call the ignorance that diverts the attention to creating something that is not a cause similar to what we aspire as a result, then that's the suffering aspect that the Buddha taught, that suffering comes because you want happiness, but the causes we create are quite the opposite. And we constantly do this. It's not a mistake that happens once, but it's a mistake that occurs again and again. And how sad that is. How unfortunate that is. How much that unnecessarily creates so much a confusion that you want to go one direction, but you are creating right the causes of, that are taking you right to the opposite of what you are aspiring. So there is that amount of confusion, which is suffering, which is painful to see happening in oneself and in the others. But as I was saying, nevertheless, there's a tremendous sort of need to also appreciate the fact that there is, despite this suffering that we create, the confusion that we create, wanting happiness, not creating the ground of happiness, still from one day to the other, that there is fair amount of goodness, fair amount of sort of civilized way of approaching that is very important. And this, if we look, how is it possible that individually, if we are producing so much confusion, that even for an individual self, we are sort of not being able to create the ground of happiness that we so much aspire. Yet, from one day to the next, this world still seems to be progressing, still seems to have some form of settledness as well as civilized way of approaching, to an extent where some people also say, where is the suffering? Yeah. So we are quite good at creating a civilization where apparentness of everything seems orderly, seems quite sane. And then we can find the answer in the absolute wisdom of the world religions, different parts of practice, different forms of practice. It doesn't matter. Some do it for heaven, to meet with God. Some do it to find your ultimate creator. Some, as Buddhists, we try to say, find fundamental absolute truth. Whether it is some goal that is very much designated, whether it is a goal that is left quite abstract. Approaches are different because potentials are different. Capabilities and what inspires the minds of human beings are very different. In the study of world religion, you will find one thing that is very, very remarkable, and that is that wherever any single religion has evolved in a certain country, you will find that that region perhaps could never be tamed the way that religion tamed that land, that number of people. So, in the same way, it took Padmasambhava to come to Tibet. Shantarakshita did wonderfully well. But still, Shantarakshita, a monk, an Indian scholar who came to Tibet, found it extraordinarily difficult to work with rather rough-minded, very stubborn, arrogant people for whom visual things were more important to find their faith in, to cultivate their faith in, rather than an intellectual, logical analysis. Now, of course, one can't say there was nobody in Tibet at that moment who preferred logical analysis over visual appearance, but predominant condition being so. In the same way, wherever Hinduism has spread, you find that the Hindu saints, the Hindu masters, and the different forms of their emanations were able to convey a message that tamed the mind of a person far more better than perhaps Buddhism could do at that moment. Wherever Islam originated, you will find that even if you put anyone, let's say Nagarjuna, for example, in that situation, it would be very difficult to actually begin to even hear, begin to have the basis of transmitting the teachings. No, because for any profound philosophy to actually grow in the mind, the hearer is very important. It's not always the speaker who's important. We Buddhists place a lot of sort of importance to emanations, for example, or the teachers, the gurus, and so forth. That's all very good. Shakyamuni himself, of course, for a Buddhist who could be more endowed with qualities of perfect enlightenment than Shakyamuni Buddha himself. But if the Shakyamuni Buddha was here, and instead of the mandala, Shakyamuni Buddha himself was there speaking, he would still be very much dependent upon ears that hear him. People who still wouldn't have time beyond Monday. Isn't it? So, therefore, hearer is very important. And a hearer has karma, hearer has capability, hearer has potential, hearer has highs and lows, hope and fear. And all of these different causes and conditions go into how you actually allow the manifest teachings to permeate within one's own mind stream. So now, those of you who are at that state of hearing the Dharma, contemplating the Dharma, therefore must recognize where the Dharma is entering into through the stream of one's hearing consciousness. It enters into the mind consciousness. It is there that the mind begins to understand what the teachings is. So the point that needs to be recognized is there are all aspects of teachings. There's the form of sitting and meditating. There are the forms of learning, studying, contemplating. There are the forms to follow traditions, to refer to lineages, and all the different kinds of aspects that lineages do bring into their path of practices. Some will emphasize logic, some will emphasize contemplation, some will emphasize meditation, some will emphasize devotion, some will emphasize much more a sense of generating more meditative sort of practices of creation and completion. There are prayers, some will emphasize. But of all of those different methods that are being emphasized in different traditions, ultimately, it is the mind that meets with the Dharma. It's your mind that meets with the Dharma. It is at that level that one must touch base with in order to make sense of what you are referring to, what you are listening to, what you are trying to cultivate. So yesterday what we talked about basically was that. As the Buddha himself says, Dharma and meeting with the Dharma itself is very profound. Taking refuge into the Dharma is very profound. It's one of the absolute rare occurrences that one is very fortunate in getting to. But the fortunate conditions and causes cannot be really brought to true fruition if the understanding of the Dharma is not accurate. Correct understanding of the Dharma that is powerful enough to becoming wisdom. And not only a knowledge wisdom, but a wisdom that has the ability to fulfill the purpose of benefiting others. Then, if that comes into fruition, then that is the required and aspired result of the path of practice. To simplify that, the question would be is, the whole purpose of your exerting this effort, which is wonderful, that you have come this far and connected and wish to connect or explore what meditation is wonderful. But that must now be brought into a fuller fruition by realizing that only a physical association is not enough. That association must go deeper into the mind embodying the Dharma. Your mind must hold the Dharma. And that Dharma must not be so much the form and the technicalities, but the essence that is permeated in the form of the meaning that is realized. So the meaning of the Dharma must be understood. If the meaning of the Dharma is understood, then that has the power to bring about what we spoke about yesterday, cessation of afflictions and the increase of wisdom within one's own self. Cessation of affliction is that as you deepen your understanding of meditation and the Dharma, you are able to recognize through mindfulness, able to recognize and discern between causes that are negative to oneself, eliminating them, causes that are beneficial to oneself and to others, and encouraging oneself to creating that. So a sense of sieving through what are things that are unnecessary, eliminating them from your life, what are good things, really producing them more, really encouraging yourself to developing better qualities more, instead of taking lives, protecting lives, instead of indulging in such actions that are only benefiting to oneself. For example, even in this context, we usually talk about adultery or being faithful in the context of householder practitioners. So your own desires, physical and mental, being so dominant that you do not care for the others. So simple things such as that, being able to take that into practice, faithfulness in relationship, loving and caring, where what you are able to give is done with absolute affection, absolute truthfulness, honesty, absolute loving and caring to the others. It doesn't make sense. Now, what we've been talking about, form practice versus the meaning brought into your own mind. Then there are some meditators who are, I think, wonderful practitioners. From a teacher's perspective, you are a diligent student. But the same person may not necessarily be a faithful partner. So then immediately there is a discrepancy that is happening. So this is what I meant by engaging in the form practice, because of which you behave well in front of a teacher. But when the same thing is not translated, where the honesty is not brought into your own daily life, then there is a dishonest approach. And that happens because the mind is not brought into the practice itself. So you're becoming more religious than a practitioner, than a meditator. So when we say meditator, Dhamma, there is no reference made to religiously following a rule or a regulation. If you follow a rule or a regulation, then you drop common sense. If you drop common sense, there's no possibility for wisdom to arise. So logical, rational way of observing, where you bring your whole mind and the experience of mind into the path of the practice, becomes essential. Simple things such as, I guess not many people steal. Now, if you steal, then don't steal. It's very direct. But at the same time, taking what is not willingly given to you. That could be a simple thing as, you know, the demands that one makes, direct and indirect. Being offered and being content in with what is being offered is a big ego killer. Isn't it? And therefore, in the beautiful tradition of Zen Buddhism, there is a lot of grace in happily accepting what is offered to you. That's why the Buddhist tradition always began with the firm sort of teaching of the Buddha, where he said, no meal should be cooked in any community. All will go out and beg. And I think you should all do it. Because that'll make you really able to address what we have become today, corporate Buddhist meditators, white-collared, with our dainty forks and knives and little napkins. Maybe you don't have it in the tent down there, but normally we do, isn't it? And so we think we are the most humble, simple, flexible, compassionate, kind Buddhist meditators who rest their mind in equanimity. But there are those little things that we do enjoy. To me, it sounds like the doilies. You call them doilies, isn't it? The lacy doilies, the silverware, the champagne glass. And so, watching yourself carefully. So, demanding something, changing that into a sense of graceful acceptance of things as they come. Ultimately, when you are going to work in training your mind to regard things as they truly are, then it also does mean that you accept things as they truly are. Only seeing, oh yes, trees are a composite of many different factors, elements. And it, you know, there have been moments when we have talked about the compositeness of phenomena. If I say, you know, table is not a table, it's all the trees and sort of the lumber and the nails and then the different artisans and so on and so forth. There's a whole line of people that will agree with me. Now, if I make it more beautiful and say there's the element of earth and the fire and the water, so it's all very fantastically new agey. So then if I say, yes, all the white is the space element, all the blue is the sky element, all the red is the fire element, you know, we can make it very beautiful. Yeah. Talk can always be very beautiful. It can be pleasing to the consciousness, the ear consciousness and the visual consciousness and so on and so forth. But at the same time, that kind of a logical reasoning, which we do take, the approach which is necessary to understand. But if that is not applicable to, you know, a piece of pizza kept on your table when you wanted salad, then, you know, the approach is, well, why is this not a salad? So there's an immediately non-application of all that fantastic, profound theory into daily activities. So where that kind of a contradiction arises in one's own mind, progress is stemmed, progress is immediately blocked. So instead of lying, truthful speaking, instead of harsh words, always making it a point to speak kindly, praise others. And therefore, in our whole tradition of Tibetan Buddhism, you will find much emphasis put in recitations that actually are nothing but praises. Praises beginning with people who are the least cause of disturbance to your life, beginning with the Buddha. So we can immediately say, you are the unsurpassable one, you are this and you are... It's full of, you read the morning recitations. He is the good one, he is the perfect one, he is the excellent one, he has all these unsurpassable... And we all agree, we have no problems with all these qualities that the Buddha has. It's the same mind that also says, well, Buddha is in the mind of every person, isn't it? You all find it much more easier to believe in the fact that every being has Buddha nature than in comparison to supplicating to the yellow-bodied Buddha in front of you. If I gave you a choice to meditate, thinking and reflecting upon the Buddha nature inherent in all sentient beings versus seeing the Buddha directly in front of you and making 100 prostrations, which one would you choose? Now you know there's a trap there. So, so everyone will say, we'll choose the second one. That's what I don't like to do, but I know there's a trap there that Rinpoche is setting up for me, so I'm going to choose what seems to be what is not preferable. But predominantly what we find is seeing the Buddha nature inherent of everyone. It is an emphasis that is made in the Buddhist contemplation and tradition meditation. That's good. That is how it is. But supplicating and making prostrations to the Buddha often is not what we like to do very much. Now, when it comes to then having respect to all the Buddhas that you encounter each day of your life, then we have some problem there. And at that moment, you will find prostrating to an imaginary yellow-bodied Buddha is much more easier than regarding each individual Sangha member as a living Buddha. Isn't it? So, again, there's a conflict between an intellectual mind that somewhat sometimes in meditation did think the permeating Buddha nature in everyone, but when it comes to actively engaging in interacting with those holders of the Buddha nature, then you don't find them. You find a man, a woman, some you like, some you don't like, some you know, some you don't know, some you would like to approach, some you do not want to approach. So at that moment, what do you see? Do you see an individual human being, or do you see the Buddha nature within? This whole aspect of hands and anjali and bowing is done with the understanding that you're connecting with the Buddha nature inherent. You're acknowledging the Buddha nature inherent. But if in doing the gesture of hands folded in anjali, You're seeing a mister, a miss, a man, a woman, you like, you don't like, you can gain from, you don't gain from. You see qualities and you do not see qualities, or you're totally indifferent to. Then what is it that hinders the mind from connecting to the fundamental nature is the form of the person. So the form dominates the very core essence, and that also reflects to how much the mind still is deciding and bringing about decisions based upon what you perceive as form, rather than taking the sort of making the effort to go into a sense of understanding true nature of that person, true nature of the reality of that person. And therefore, in training the mind to think good of the others, praises, as we were saying, is very essential. It allows you to locate those qualities that often are not emphasized because of the immense power of form that becomes the decisive sort of factor that makes you generate an opinion. An opinion generated based only upon what is apparent has no trace of a clear understanding of the things that come into being, all the different parts that come into gatheredness, the compositeness to create that situation. So in this way, eliminating sort of negative habits, training yourself to removing harsh speech, slander, idle gossip, which has the flavor of all three. Idle gossip has lying, idle gossip has slander, idle gossip has harshness in it. By and large, we cannot have a gossip which doesn't have these flavors in them. So instead of that, training the mind, training the speech to be kind, to be more focused upon the positive qualities of the others, to remain silent, to be encouraging of the others. Mentally, instead of selfishness, covetousness, training the mind to be genuinely patient with every situation as it arises. Whatever arises can be met with grace, with flexibility, with a sense of embracing that moment as it arises, with all the trainings, with all the learnings, with all the wisdom that you know. You're not sitting in a Buddhist talk for the first time in your life. Some people are fairly new, but even so, yesterday was enough substance to work with. Day before yesterday and yesterday both is a lot of substance. Last week and this year is a lot of substance. Your own life is a lot of substance to begin to work with. To have the poverty mentality that I don't have enough, to begin to relate to the unfolding moment of nowness in a skillful, in a more compassionate way, is letting the poverty mentality really dominate. So defeating poverty mentality is by looking at you actually have everything that you need, all conducive factors that you need to meet with every unfolding moment in the best way possible. Simply because I cannot believe you've never heard the word patience in your life. How many more Himalayan ways of defining what patience is will it be required before you do learn to embrace patience in a very simple way? That you have never heard the word simplicity, humility, flexibility, joyfulness, kindness, lovingly, gentleness. These have nothing to do with Buddhism or Tibetan Buddhism. So, as I always say, don't make your life so miserable that you assume that these can be learned only through hundreds and hours of sitting in those awkward postures. The point here is, what are you doing with your life? by your association to such a path called the profound Dharma, one must connect to this essential point is, what is Dharma? What is it that you're connecting to? Freeing the tendencies of simple kind of membership association with a philosophy, but allowing the connection that is very profound to reveal its genuine profoundness by allowing that to really work at the level of your own mind. And what does that mean is the mind's way of thinking, the mind's way of deciding, the mind's way of looking at things. How you look at things must become dharmic. How you interpret what you are seeing, what you are encountering, must become dharmic. Having encountered with form, having encountered with sound, encountering thoughts, how are you articulating that? How are you meeting with that? How are you interpreting your experiences? And because of how you are interpreting, the decisions that you project, the thoughts that are the opinions or the decisions that you make must become dharmic, must become permeating with the essence of all the teachings that you have learned. And therefore, how you meet each unfolding moment must be done with the amount of teachings that you have received. All that you have heard, all that you think makes sense. If patience makes sense, if having a much more larger perspective of how things are makes sense, if being more flexible in your attitude as you meet with unfolding situations makes sense, if being kinder and more loving makes sense, if humility and gentleness makes sense, then those things must be evident in how you meet with unfolding moments. So that is where, instead of the habitual, so when we say, let the mind not be succumbing or subjugated by the discursivenesses and the afflictions. Another word we use is transform negative emotions, transcend afflictions, let go of bias and partiality, let go of grasping and craving. What do these mean? Is that all of these are different ways of articulating the same meaning. And that is, as each moment unfolds, you meet them by finding among all the different qualities that you have understood, see which one would make it the best encountering, which would allow you to meet with each arising moment in a way that is much more deeper and connected to positive basic goodness, rather than sort of the influence of everything that otherwise we would generate, the hurried decisions of preferences, the hurried projections of afflictions, all of these tendencies, habitual patterns, afflictions that we would succumb to. Would this mind not be aware of meeting with the moment with greater mindfulness, with greater awareness? And so here, therefore, yesterday as we talked about meeting with the Dharma, being profound, but the Dharma must carry the essence in your mind that reduces the afflictions. Reduction of the afflictions is by the mindfulness that transforms each habitual pattern by disintegrating its power, and the mindfulness increasing a much more pervasive aspect, which is encouraged by all the learnings that you have done. All your hearing, all your contemplation, all your meditation must then gather an essence that inspires you to meeting it in a much more newer way, in a way that is more fresh, fresh in the sense that it does not follow the same habitual patterns. So you meet with that moment, and it is only in that way that the afflictions can be reduced. So mindfulness is one of the core factors that is able to bring about the fruition of the meaning of Dharma, which is cessation of afflictions. If mindfulness is not there, then cessation is very difficult. Where cessation is not happening, then only form of the Dharma is being engaged upon. the genuine essence of the Dharma that transcends and tames the mind is not happening. Where this first part of the Dharma, cessation of affliction, happens, arising of the wisdom encompassing the mind, or the mind fully aware of the wisdom, must also be there. So yesterday we talked about the second aspect of what is Dharma, and that is the manifesting of the wisdom in one's own mind. Just as the receding or the weakening of the afflictions happen, increasing of the wisdom must be there. And the increase of the wisdom is then in, as the Buddha himself has taught, knowing things to be as they are, completely cutting through and destroying wrong view. And so here, therefore, the Pratityasamutpada, as we talked about yesterday, interdependent origination, is the main sort of teaching of the Buddha in his 45 years of his teachings that allows the mind to understand the true nature of things as they evolve. The understanding of which, now, if somebody simply said, why are we learning interdependent origination? Then the answer, simple answer, is without an understanding of interdependent origination, one doesn't really understand mind very well and the functionings of the mind very well. Where you are on a path to developing a strong mindfulness that breaks free from afflictions, there, if that mind that is being tamed doesn't understand true nature of reality, then one begins to have a tendency of almost underestimating the power of habitual patterns. You underestimate the power of afflictions, and you overestimate the power of your mindfulness and awareness. And so because of that, then, you know, a lot of things happen on the path of practice which sort of defeats the motivation, which obstructs the path of realization and liberation. So there are lots of things that we go towards, but we don't consider many different things that will come in the process of reaching that destination and goal. So we think, oh, I'm going to study interdependent origination, Four Noble Truths, and the Samadhis. But in between that, a lot of times the mind doesn't consider many different things. It doesn't bargain for weather conditions. It doesn't bargain for all the other things that can come in between that sort of an aspiration of the teachings and the path of practice and meditation. Same example can be taken to the path of realization. It's you, and then the absolute enlightenment, the purpose of benefiting other sentient beings. These are the grosser things, point one and point Z, that we keep in mind. A meditator who then underestimates such a process and all the encounterings that you will face from the starting point to the point of that resultant state, doesn't become aware of the actual path that needs to go through the path of transformation and transcendence. Just as the stormy weathers and unexpected rain and wind and all of these things that can come, in the same way, here on the path of practice, from your meditation to the path of enlightenment, to the resultant state of enlightenment, there will be storms, there will be hurricanes, tornadoes, volcanoes, earthquakes, peaceful weather also, sometimes. But basically, the whole journey is going to be about your mind and breaking free from all those familiar patterns, which are very challenging. Now, to meet those challenges on your own, since the Buddha does say, independent, or that enlightenment is dependent upon you. You are yourself responsible for your own liberation. There is nobody who is going to give you that. You have to find out. Since you are on the journey, yes, of course, the teachings support you. Forms of meditation support you. But even the form and the teachings have to be taken by the mind. And the mind has to travel the journey of all the different highs and lows and different familiar habitual patterns that will arise. Now, in encountering those storms of the mind, in encountering some of the outbursts of the mind, in encountering the discouragements that the mind will generate. All the good things and all the adverse circumstances that the mind will permeate or generate, to be able to still have the wisdom withstand those different occurrences of the mind, the formidable or the most sort of indestructible tool or weapon that will support your mind is the understanding of interdependent origination. Through understanding law of causality, through understanding karma, through understanding particularly how things come into being, and the dependency, codependency of cause, effect, effect that becomes cause for another effect, the multiplicity, multiple ways through which causes and conditions can connect and reconnect with one another, when the mind begins to have a clearer understanding of it, it relates to adversities and all positive circumstances with a far more clearer perspective and an understanding of situations as they are. So the mind is not immediately or directly impacted and aggravated by that particular situation. It is about how much a knowing mind relates to a situation more openly. You know, and therefore you can have a much more ability to have a pervasive view. What you are entering, if it's completely an unknown territory, there's so much apprehension that the apprehension itself completely sort of quenches or can immediately be distorted, particularly by the ego and the habitual patterns, into discouragement, into disappointment. So on the path of the practices, therefore, meditators encounter emotions. It's the same emotions. But then when you meet them in meditation, they become so very powerful that it paralyzes you with fear, bringing discouragement to what? To the path of meditation. So therefore, it is very important that through the understanding of the law of causality, that a thorough understanding, more deepened understanding of how things are, outer phenomena, how they come into being. And through that, as yesterday the Buddha said, finding a healthy relationship that can allow you to embrace things in a much more vaster vision, flexible vision, with much more sort of an open, fuller vision, rather than a narrow linear vision where it is only sort of the eye that needs to be accommodated with every arising moment is important. So therefore, here as we go into the nidanas and talk about the nidanas, I thought the first thing that was very important, especially for those of you who are learning all these words and different ways of approaching Buddhist teachings, to have an sort of an orientation of the mind, what you're doing, what is it that you're trying to do over here? What you're trying to do over here is learn the Dhamma. What is Dhamma is that the Dhamma must have these two powers, cessation of affliction and the wisdom that knows things as they truly are. Cessation of affliction comes through the cultivation of mindfulness. But even for this mindfulness, the power of awareness of things how they truly are is very important. The wisdom of knowing things as they truly are important. How do things actually come into being? And how do things actually come into being are much more directly explained within the teachings known as interdependent originations, or in Sanskrit simply called Pratityasamudapada, in Pali Patityasamudapada. And so yesterday, an enumeration of the 12 nidanas is what we went into, and here too is the point where I will then sort of go into Asanga's teaching, where he says, law of causality, the 12 interdependent origination that explains it, must be thoroughly understood in its true essence. Causality shouldn't be misunderstood. Asanga says, causality shouldn't be misunderstood as a dynamic, powerful cause. It would be misunderstanding, and a misunderstanding that happens also in regards to karma, which is also cause and effect. Or karma, the word itself simply means action. An action that has the full potency of creating an impactful experience, and an experience that itself has the full potency of further creation and recreation. Not only a recreation, but a recreation that can be so explosive that it can go in a multitude of diverse ways, and therefore multiple causes can come from a single cause. A multiple consequence can become a single cause. A single cause can become multiple consequences. So sort of the diversities of understanding what action is, what karma is. However, if in the mind of a person, and since we are so used to references, and references immediately capture the mind into solidifying and making it conceptual, very oftentimes a conceptual understanding of karma, or even causality, law of causality, or just the causes come very strongly. So we think cause is a dynamic, very powerful single cause. So Asanga says, understanding the impermanent nature of causes is important. Causes, or law of causality, simply says everything is impermanent in nature. There is change, there is transition happening constantly. Not knowing the change is ignorance. Not knowing the transitory nature of causes is ignorance. Impermanent by its own self, causes are impermanent by its own self. So changes happen, constant transitions happen, things come into being, things go into a state of dissolution or destruction. Impermanence also happens by meeting with other conditions, conditions that become a catalyst in bringing about death, in bringing about destruction of something that is produced. Many different conditions can become powerful in having a cause become impermanent, become changed, become into origin and into exhaustion. Impermanence must also be understood by the power of its coming into being, being the cause of its destruction. So three kinds of impermanence has to be understood with regards to causes. Causes are by nature impermanent, that is the first. Causes become impermanent where the catalyst can be other conditions. And causes, because of their origin, by themselves also become, by virtue of their own origin, also become extinct. So when one thinks about these three ways where the impermanence is explained, one begins to have an understanding of cause, or the word cause, the term cause, in a slightly different approach. Where that different approach is not understood, then the question often that comes up is, who is the first cause, or what is the first cause, and so forth. You know, a lot of Buddhists struggle with that when we talk about causes and conditions making things originate. They always think about the first Big Bang, or the first cause, or what was the primary cause that brought about the ignorance, and so forth. So one, if one, however, looks at the ever-changeable sort of nature of the causes that are coming, which is always in constant sort of transitions, constant change, then one does know much more perspective, a bigger perspective, a vaster perspective that is not taking a cause to be ultimately a single cause. So ultimately, there is not a single cause. There are all the different many facets of conditions and causes that are in constant influx. And therefore, wherever there is a dynamic energy that creates the right causes and conditions, things have the potential of coming into being. So it's a much more larger perspective, a much more vaster perspective of seeing, which is almost similar to another analogy that could be given, is when you look at this world, this planet Earth of our own self, we become so very absorbed in the planet Earth that we do not appreciate everything else that is in the galaxy. But if a person were to be able to look at the entire galaxy, you would find that planet Earth is actually a very minute part of the whole. In the same way, when we look at causality, if we look at causality as a person obsessed with only the planet Earth, my cause, this cause, then that is looking at a cause from a very partial understanding, without seeing the vastness of every single cause that is actually dependent upon hundreds and thousands of other different causes and conditions that each have, if it crashes, the full potential of manifesting things, of creating things. And so when the linear vision of the person comes into being, we begin to think, me, my life, it has a beginning. We're so fond of all the stories. For example, children are always taught, if you look at a very, I always mention that, the very common feature in the way we teach children how to look at stories is that there are all the children book stories that almost always begin with once upon a time, isn't it? So the mind immediately has begun to get a culture of trying to say once upon a time, yesterday, today, afterwards, past, present, and future. So the mind is very much structured in thinking with reference to very solid time, very solid structure, very solid references. So we try to bring into being able to relate with all arising moment by saying once upon a time the origin of this thought was somewhere. So we need to sort of box them up in all different kinds of categories. And when we do that, then we fall into this whole question of what is the first cause, the second cause, which caused this and which caused that. But that is then the linear way of looking at it. So Asanga says that is always going to lead a meditator to have a partial, very solid or a very conceptual way of looking at causes and conditions. It is much more necessary that the causes, the law of causality, be understood in a much more sort of a larger perspective of many causes and conditions that are rampantly there, that each one of them have the potential of creating different situations. What does become a very prominent situation is what you grasp, what you hold. It is similar to, for example, is your mind goes through many different hundreds of thoughts per day. But of all those many thoughts, you pick out certain amounts of thoughts, certain feelings. And so whatever you grasp, whatever you are able to hold, that becomes very, very big. That becomes sort of the very dominant sort of the concept that remains in your own mind. If you look at sort of the theme parks, or different kinds of children parks, amusement parks, then there are those different kinds of tennis balls that you can throw and hit something and you get a toy as a prize. Now, same kind of hundreds of toys are hanging up there. You strike something, it hits, and because of which you get one little toy. If you look at children, or even, you know, women do it especially, I think, when you get that toy, yours is very different from all of those 100 toys that are hanging there. There's immediately an affinity towards it. It's the same mass production of toys. There's no difference. But still, you know, you have those people walk around the park holding them to your chest, and you find how dominating that kind of a fixation is. Thoughts are like that. Concepts are like that. Causes are like that. There are all kinds of causes. Millions of causes constantly in function. What you hold most dear to yourself, what you allow your own grasping and fixation to immediately hold on, that becomes very strong. And the whole struggle of life becomes what you do with what you have then held on to. You know, it's like making clothing for this teddy bear when you come back. You buy a little pram for the teddy bear that you have got. You place it on the high shelf, and then you have a guest at home, and the guest decides to put his or her toothbrush instead of the bear on that shelf. And you walk in and you decide, I'm never going to invite that guest ever again. That's the place for my toy. You know, so that's how one plays. That's how one thing leads to the next. That's how what you have grasped becomes bigger and bigger. That's how emotions, what is simply a thought, becomes anger, becomes attachment, becomes yours, becomes ours, becomes theirs, ours versus theirs. And that's what sets off the aggravation, sets off all kinds of different patterns. So the origin of it is, amongst all the causes, those causes that you hold very, very strongly becomes the starting point. So when we talk about the first nidana, yesterday Jingmi Lingpa's text was what I was referring to. Now, in that case, he says, what is ignorance, the very first that leads to a empty or a sort of a cause without any kind of power of its own to be grasped and then to give it the power of manifold manifestations is then said to be ignorance. Now, in the case of the first dana, ignorance, what is it, ignorance? Most of the teachings will always say ignorance is not knowing the true nature and stepping into a sense of something else being more vibrant than what is the fundamental nature. Yesterday we talked about, now in the text itself it says, the first interdependent origination, which is ignorance, is referred to, especially in the Vajrayana teachings, as ignoring the true nature of phenomena, not knowing the true nature of phenomena, projecting things that do not exist, and then becoming deluded and confused. So partially what we have been talking about here is that where there is no ultimate one single dominant entity existing, an assumption that it is leads to the first sort of movement away from knowing its fundamental nature. Many people think that there is a first fundamental ignorance. Sometimes we talked about it. But that is, again, a very linear way of looking at it. The fundamental ignorance is every moment that you think what you see, what you hear is more real than what it actually is having succumbed to the first interdependent link or to the ignorance. Many ignorances, the continuum of which is so unceasing, sort of makes it look like we have one big ignorance, but it's actually ignorance of every moment. Ignorance of form, as you see, ignorance of sound, as you hear, ignorance of smell, ignorance of taste, ignorance of texture that you feel bodily, ignorance of thoughts, mental feelings and emotions that you feel. At every moment as it arises, as a meditator, be mindful of all the moments that you sidestep what the nature is to go into what you feel, what you are experiencing. And each moment that you actually shift your attention to the supposition that something is there is the being influenced by the ignorance. You're manifesting ignorance at that moment. And so the first way and the most sort of helpful way for a meditator to work with the concept of ignorance is to experience that in one's own everyday moment, how often you succumb to it. So there's not one big sort of a devilish kind of an ignorance that constantly comes and hinders our mindfulness and our ability to realize the true nature. You're actually bringing in the flavor of ignorance at every moment that you mistake something to be there, where the form is there, where the sound is there, wherever one's mind says, oh, it is there. It is this that is being created. It is there that I must respond to. There's immediately a sense of ignorance. Therefore, here, ignorance is not necessarily anything negative. It is only called ignorance because of the dominant sort of tendency of not knowing the true nature, not being able to see the fullness of the nature. Probably true nature is also quite misleading a term at this level. Instead of true nature, you could say the fuller nature of things as they are, some totality of things as they are. Acute mindfulness would be is when you hear a sound, beyond just the perception of the sound, you would be able to hear all different factors that do go into the creation of the sound. There's a sense of deepened appreciation. It may not be, again, as when we speak about it, it seems like a very difficult thing to do. So you would have to then say, I'd have to locate where the sound is coming from, who is making it, with what kind of an emotion, how does it sound, how is it not different, all the different factors that go into it. As a meditator on the path of learning how to meditate, yes, you have to be as attentive to all the factors that are there. But as the mind trains in hearing a sound and seeing all the different factors that go into creating one sound becomes a familiar habit in your own mind. Gradually, a trained meditator comes to a point where you see the wholesomeness of a sound, and that idea, that understanding is much more strong than how do I like the sound. So the I that sort of imposes itself on the sound, asserts itself on the sound, is less. The sound is much more strong than the asserting of the I who hears the sound. So the appreciation of the sound is more than how the opinion of the sound is, or what your opinion of the sound is. So being familiar with mindfulness generates that kind of a appreciation. That appreciation is then said to be knowing more deeply nature of sound or nature of form or anything our senses then are able to see. That then allows a much more patient approach to things as they truly are, rather than where the I asserts, and therefore it is all about how the I feels, and a disregard for the other and the participation of all the other factors that go into creating a situation. So therefore, selfishness would be is the assertion of the self over everything that arises. Kindness is where, as everything arises, is much more accepted for what they are rather than how it depends or how it impacts the self, the I. And so ignorance, therefore, is every moment where the assertion of the self is more dominant in every picture. When you go into a room, another small example would be when you go into a room, we always say, do you carry the I into the room? Or do you actually take the room and then you blend yourself in the room? It's a simple exercise. When you enter into a situation, do you assert the I into the situation? If you assert the I into the situation, you're definitely not going to make friends. You'll always wait for others to accommodate you. And it's very uncomfortable. Isolation comes because of that. Wherever there is less dominance of the self being asserted into a situation, situation becomes much more accommodating, flexible, because you can then permeate yourself into all different aspects. You embrace whatever arises in a much more friendlier approach. So the ignorance, the first is where the assertion of the I is so strong that the I itself completely blinds the reality of things as they are. So, sort of the first thing to contemplate upon is how that is something that is repeatedly done in everything that we do. When you are listening to sound, is the I asserting more, or is it there the sense of appreciating the sound as it is more? Observe that. When you are generating a thought, again, if that thought does not get interfered by the assertion of the self, then what happens to the thought? By itself, it doesn't have the power of doing anything, recreating anymore. Wherever the I is asserted, it immediately becomes very, very strong, very, very heavy, heavy-handed. So being able to simply look at that, being able to really observe the tendencies of the ignorance, the not knowing its own true nature, it goes into assuming something else. in meditation, it's a very slight impulse, and therefore Jigme Lingpo very beautifully actually in the text refers to it as maybe not so much an ignorance as much as an idea. It's the idea of something other than what is. A very tiny impulse or a tiny sort of a inclination more towards, impulse towards having an idea of something being there. When that idea shifts your gaze, shifts your concentration from whatever is the fundamental nature to what you suppose it to be, then immediately the impact of the previous results in the next, as Jigme Lingpa says, karmic creation happens. The second nidana is called karmic formation or formation or simply karmic creation. Now, one of the interesting things that is there is the usage of certain words. For example, karmic creation here is referred to as disposition. In English, it would be disposition or inclination. Or even one of the good things about Lojong Rinpoche is one text where he says, if you look at the axis of a balance and the axis tips towards any weight, wherever the weight is, the axis tips towards that. Karmic formation is your mind's balance, the axis of your balance being persuaded by wherever there is more weight. So that's the disposition, that's the inclination. So wherever the equanimity of remaining in its own true nature shifts because of the weight of distraction, wherever the mind moves away to an inclination that there supposes or it supposes something is there, when a thought arises in your mind and immediately you feel the impulse to be focused upon it being there. So that's the weight of the thought grasped at, which makes that concentration more inclined towards the distraction, then that is said to be the first fully manifest sort of a concentration on what is not one's own true nature. So therefore, when this happens, then according to the Nidana teachings, one says there immediately are two stages that are created. In simple words, wherever there is an idea, the following of that idea creates the karma, creates the first cause. So how does causes come into being is just the activeness of the mind. Mind inherently, that which cannot be found, as we say. There is no such thing as an entity called mind. Nevertheless, mind's one of most spectacular qualities is that it is awake, it is active, it is able to perform. That same activeness of the mind, the nature of the mind, however, does also have a rhythm, which if the balance is not clearly maintained, and that's why mindfulness becomes so important, is where the mindfulness is not there, the activeness of the mind itself can create a kind of a ripple, kind of an action, where the concentration may be overweighed towards responding to its activity. Where the responding to the activity arises, there is full potential for karma, for causes to be created. And so here one talks about what is called in the Padurubhache's teachings or the karma text, mostly resultant karma and causal karma are defined. Those of you who read about karma will find these two terms. But there's one very sort of poignant way of writing it here. So I'm going to simply go through a very loose translation of it and let you write that down if you are writing down. It says, since the mind, ignorant of its own nature, produces an idea of something else, it propels the generation of an action, and then these actions have later consequences and create a powerful energy or powerful possibility which can be called bringing together circumstances or karmic creations. So this is the first that is defined, which is called bringing together circumstances. All kinds of circumstances brought together, called karmic creations. Secondly, the other aspect of karma, which is called cause for developing a tendency. In which an action has the power of creating a conditioning effect, making it easier to perform the same action next time. So when one's mind loses its balance to then have an idea of the other, anything other than its own nature, it has an idea, it immediately propels itself into an action. That action can have two sort of aspects. Therefore, one is called resultant aspect of karma. The first, as we talked about, which is called bringing together circumstances. It is the performance of many different actions that or causes and conditions that it meets with that has the full power of manifesting a cause. And the second is where the repetition happens. It is the causal karma, where repetitions happen, which makes it become a familiar habit for one's own self. And so whenever there is a sense of the mind moving away from its own ground of awareness, a pervasive awareness of its own nature, and especially here when we talk about its own nature, leaving it at that at the moment. Now, if many say, what is the nature? What is the nature of mind? Then the nature of mind is a topic that I would like to take into the meditation part of it. So here what we are talking about is what is not the nature of mind. And so all that what is not the nature of mind, when the balance shifts towards that, an idea is developed. That idea has the potential of immediately becoming a cause for many different experiences to happen. Many different experiences that happen do become, again, they are a consequence. They are a resultant experience. But each resultant experience also have the second aspect of the karma, which is another cause for repetitions, for familiarization. So when both of these are happening repeatedly, you're responding, that is a karma, then that repetition, that itself response becomes more manifest as different kinds of experiences. Let's take an example. Is that first thought of distraction. That distraction becomes much more solidified as a thought. That thought itself then produces another thought. So therefore, the produced thought, the resultant thought, also has the potency of becoming a cause for another thought. So therefore, causes are causes, but cause is also a result. And what you are experiencing as a result has also the possibility of becoming a cause for another or many other causes. And so the multiplicity of the distraction here is being talked about. When we talk about nidanas, and especially in terms of ignorance leading to karmic formation, we're basically talking about a very subtle movement of the mind that goes into the supposition of the other than what is not its own nature. And immediately that being sort of mixing up or becoming more interfered with. You play around with it until it becomes sort of a bigger thought, bigger concept. So the third here, consciousness that we are talking about, the third nidana, therefore always talks about causal consciousness and resultant consciousness. Just as with the ignorance, if one thinks ignorance is one big thing, that's a mistake. Likewise, if one thinks consciousness is one consciousness, that's also a mistake. So therefore, one says, oh, so does the consciousness go from one to the life, to the next, to the life, and so on and so forth, rebirth of consciousness. That's a linear way of thinking about consciousness. Therefore, here in accordance to the nidanas, consciousness is simply seen as, yesterday we used the word database, where all imprints are stored, but not necessarily a thing, not necessarily an entity. Wherever, whenever the balance of our equilibrium of our mind moves to more distracted states and causes are created, these causes are created. For example, repeated thoughts that you are generating. Think of all the thoughts that you are generating at every moment. Some thoughts are immediately produced and apparent in action, but the same thoughts also create an imprint in your mind that are stored at a base, and one cannot find that base. But nevertheless, within the stream of your mind, that information is based, because of which it builds up to becoming your personality, your habits. So another example would be is all the moments of irritation that you project to the others makes your personality aggressive. All the moments of sort of discouragement that you give to yourself builds a personality of laziness. All the moments of generously liking others builds a personality of a very kind person. So there are two things that we are talking about. A projected cause that continuously is experienced. So you're projecting irritation, you're projecting kindness, you're projecting all different kinds of ideas. It's constantly creating an immediate karma, an immediate experience that's happening. But more subtle than what is apparent action, you are also creating almost a sort of settling of all the sediments, building up a bank of dust. In the same way, settling of all those subtler thoughts that does build up to becoming your personality. Where it is built up is then called the causal consciousness. And so here the sort of the words that are used over here is the influence of the idea of ignorance creates a design. And so it's a very beautiful way of saying, whenever the ignorant mind moves away into karmic formation, that is called where the balance is then impacted in such a way that you have an idea that is anything other than the basic nature. When that idea now can be made into creating a design, that is then called karmic formation. When the design becomes very clear, that is called consciousness. So in your own mind, if you take that to looking at it, is whenever the thought sways into some other distraction, that is the idea. Where this idea has a design. Now, it's not only a sort of a distraction that's very abstract, but that distraction could be, let's say, in some form of subtle irritation. Then the irritation is the design. So you're creating a design for it. So in that way, the designing of an idea that supposes something to be there beyond the true nature is the creation of the three links or the three interdependent links, the ignorance, the karmic formation, and the consciousness. And so all the different levels of consciousnesses that are talked about, of course, there's the six or the eight consciousness that Buddhist teachings talk about. But keeping it simple over here, consciousness should be more simply seen as two things. One, which allows you to design things, which allows and gives you the ability to design your thoughts, design the concepts, design the different ways of now how you are going to move forward with what you have allowed to be believe is other than your own true nature. But the second subtler aspect of that same designing is it does create a bank of information, an impact that it continuously creates, so that later on you may not have to come as far back as ignorance. Just that there is a familiar habit and you can have references to your own distraction, the designing of the distraction, is sufficient. So in the context of birth and rebirth, we say all of the different kinds of karma that we create in this world, the hundreds of different kinds of causes that we create in this world, actually die at the time when your body disintegrates. So the familiar patterns of your body, your speech, your mind, when the physical body dies, that consciousness dies. Your eye consciousness dies, your ear consciousness dies, your mouth consciousness dies, your mind consciousness, the kind of mental thought patterns that your heart, mind can create, those die. But nevertheless, the continuity of the rebirth is simply because it goes into the bank, the database, into that sediments of familiar patterns that it is familiar, such as when the next rebirth takes place. Nobody has to teach you to be irritated. You can delve into the database and find the connecting point. And that's what's then very similar to, if we simplify that in living moments, it's the personality. So every time you respond to a situation, you're not actually touching base with your own true nature. You're touching base only with the database, with the impact that is familiar, and only as deep as the consciousness level, never to the level of the ignorance where it is taking place. So the meditative approach that is taken is so that you can go beyond the consciousness to the point of your own true nature, where the root problem of ignorance is. So the Buddha did not say suffering arises because the consciousness is not brilliant or aware. He says suffering arises because of ignorance. But the ignorance is often never reached at, because we are always working at the level of the third link, the consciousness. But the consciousness has been spoiled. It's pampered. Consciousness is pampered and spoiled because the retaining of its own habitual patterns have been all stored. And that storage, that where the habitual patterns constantly becomes a message that is imprinted, is also sometimes called mind, and therefore consciousness and mind sometimes have been spoken in the same light. And so we say mind is untamed. Sometimes we say consciousness is untamed. We begin to look at the parallelities of mind and consciousness, and there is no arguing that there are similarities, because that's the basis. But from the Buddhist perspective, we say that is just the temporary mind. When we talk about mind, we're talking about the primary nature, the very fundamental nature. But that fundamental nature can't be reached because at the level of consciousness, there's so much information that you trust more. And the information that you trust more is held by the biggest supporting, and that is familiarization. So consciousness familiarizes itself, so familiar. If you respond to this in this way, it is familiar how you will feel. You know, even in those moments we say, when you get upset, one of the very good ways to look into your own self is, in that moment of being upset, you know, especially as a Buddhist who's trained to be mindful, you know that's a wrong thing to do. You know, you're stopping it, but still the words are coming out of your mouth. It's followed by regret. You know exactly how the other person is going to feel. You know the tiresome effort you'll have to put into apologizing afterwards. It's going to be tiring. Your and his or her or your relationship is going to be bad for some moment. You even know it's going to last 3 days, 4 days. But you also know it's going to be forgotten. So there are all of these very subtle, familiar things that you are aware of that dominates your mind. Where it dominates, the familiarity of how you are relating to dominates your mind, what's happening is that the belief of this entertainment becomes bigger and bigger, more and more real. The entertainment of tiredness, the apology, the regret, the aggression, the feeling hot with the aggression, not liking it, the other person being upset, you're hugging the person, all of those different dramas that we go into become very familiar. Now, that familiarity, what happens is, keeps the axis bent to the weight of the distraction more. And so, if we look at human life, basically from this perspective, then we will see all that what we are doing seems to be is an imbalance that has to be maintained. Imagine your car, and when you do those kind of, what do you call them? When you drive, and one those are racers, or I don't know what you would call them, often do those tricks where you make, instead of four wheels drive, you swerve, and so you drive on two wheels, where you can topple over. You know that. But it's almost the same, is that you do that throughout your life. It's a risk you take. And therefore, consciousness is the constant familiarity with all the risks that you take that you don't necessarily like. But it happens in such rampantness that it requires all our concentration to respond to everything that is habitual, that is familiar. And so how do we grow old? How do we get tired? How do we get exhausted in life? Of course, if you're trying to do a wheelie with your life, balancing this response to the familiar habitual patterns all your life, then the responding to everything that you've made so very complex and neurotic and confusing is never going to give you the time to even address the issues such as ignorance. Is that clear? So the sense of working with the consciousness and the retaining of the consciousness's responses, the constant familiarity. For example, when you have a thought, you have to observe how that thought itself dives directly into familiarity with how you have. You have to find somewhere a connection. Oh, this is that thought. It is in the department of liking. It is in the department of not liking. It is in the department of later on, pending projects. You dive into that information, make some sense, and you respond to it in that particular way. And so the crucial point of a meditator, of course, all the links are, as the Patitasamutapada says, one that originates from the other. But at the same time, the consciousness is the point where the most sort of the storage of the information happens, and therefore one of the very dominating factors. Where that consciousness retains all the information and the familiarity is projected, then name and form, two of the most significant structures through which the concepts arises, begins to take place. Name and form, as we said yesterday, name refers to all of the different aggregates that we give a concept to, that we give a label to, and form is the rupa kaya, or the form aggregate. In order to understand the fourth interdependent origination, understanding somewhat the aggregates become important. Five aggregates. The first aggregate is the form aggregate. According to the Buddhist tradition, the belief that we need to create that balance. Now remember, we talked about ignorance that believes something is there which is not the true nature. Now what is that something? What diverts our awareness towards the direction of something to be there is said to be the formation of aggregates. If the aggregates and the nature of the aggregates are not understood, then the solidification of the self-grasping is always going to be strong. Another way of putting it is, what does not make us understand the true nature is the dominance of the aggregates. So from the Mahayana's perspective, what is the true nature is never explained. What is not the true nature that creates all the confusion is what is explained. So in the context of the Nidanas, we're talking about ignorance, the first confusion. How does the first confusion arise? What creates this karmic formation? What creates the consolidation of the third consciousness, as we just spoke about, primarily is because of the dominance of the aggregates. So not understanding the compositeness of the aggregates, we begin to have a belief of what is only apparent. And where that belief becomes strong, there is full nourishment for the ignorance to continually persist. So knowledge of the aggregates then becomes very crucial. In the context of the Nidanas, if the aggregates are understood, name and form doesn't come into being. So when name and form doesn't come into being, consciousness has no pathway to walk upon and make solidity of concepts. But where aggregates are not understood, name and form are brought into construction. And where name and form become a solid concept, consciousness has full, all the different necessary implements that it needs to retain its supposition of being something. And therefore, the belief of the ignorant mind always is much more strong. So the aggregates need to be understood, and therefore, again, according to the sutra, the aggregates are explained as five aggregates: aggregate of form, aggregate of feeling, aggregate of perception, aggregate of formation, karmic formation, and aggregate of consciousness. Aggregate of form, what is also called rupa or rup, are all material or physical factors, which includes not only our body, but also all the material objects that surround us. And so, for a meditator, it's important to really reflect. For example, if you're going to practice meditation, samadhi, you have to be able to understand what is form aggregate. Trees, oceans, mountains, the rain, the earth that you walk upon, the building, the cushion, where you sit, your body are form aggregates. And therefore, really being mindful of the form that surrounds you, the form that you are, form that surrounds you, being able to look at the aggregate of form clearly. Especially here, it says all the five physical senses that one has, and all the physical sense objects that we connect with. Eyes, ears, nose, mouth, the body, and the mind. These senses and the physical sense consciousnesses, sense objects that it works with, and that is forms that you see, sound you hear, smell that you smell, or the fragrance you smell, taste of the tongue, texture of the body, and emotions, feelings, sensations that your mind feels. These are also part of the rupa aggregate or the form aggregate. Second is feeling. Feeling aggregate is divided into three aspects: pleasant feelings, unpleasant feelings, and indifferent feelings or neutral feelings. When any of the sense objects are experienced, and this then has an emotional tone to it, that is then called the aggregate of feeling. So as a meditator, again, really having acute sense of mindfulness of feeling. All that what you feel, pleasant, gross and subtle, such as gentleness, peacefulness, heightened sort of emotions, whatever it is, strong, pleasurable feelings, pleasant feelings, observing them. Those are the feeling aggregates. Unpleasant feelings, subtle and gross, whether they are slight discomforts to heightened aggressive feelings or emotional pain or disturbances that you feel, recognizing them as aggregate of feelings. Indifferent feelings, distractions, dullness, self-absorption, interference with everything, laziness, sleep, drowsiness, those are also all kinds of indifferent feelings, subtle and gross. These are the key to emotions, and therefore feelings must be observed where a meditator is able to really see as these arises, when an unpleasant arises, saying this is unpleasant feeling. Where something pleasant arises, this is pleasant feeling, so that you recognize what is the aggregate of feeling. Third is the aggregate of perception. Now, sort of different ways of explaining perception have been there. Mainly, perception are often regarded as recognition and identity or identifying something. Here, however, the definition of the perception is given as where an experience, an indefinite experience, is turned into an identified and recognized experience. So the feeling and the perception, the relationship between it, is that the feeling is quite an indefinite experience. When it becomes identified, when it becomes recognized, when there is a formulation of a concept, an idea is full-fledged, then that becomes a stronger, definite experience. That becomes perception. And therefore, pleasure, displeasure, or the indifference all come into a full-fledged manifest concept or an idea. With regard to even the first two, second and the third nidana, karmic formation and consciousness, here too we see the immense influence of the aggregates that consolidate and give us a sense of idea and the design of our concept. So that's immediately any feeling has given been given a definite shape, and that is then the power of the aggregate of perception. So whenever your mind begins to become more contrite in terms of rigid ideas, formulated ideas, you like this, you do not like this, you have a way of actually articulating your own ideas, then that build-up of the concept is happening because of the perception aggregate. So this is the perception aggregate that must be noticed in the minds of one's own self in meditation. Fourth is then mental formation. The aggregate that is described as conditioned response to the experience. And so, how do you respond to an experience? How do you respond to an experience? Whenever you have a pleasurable, displeasurable, or indifferent experience or emotion, when you have perception, when you have feelings, how do you respond to them? You respond to them with familiarity. So earlier when we talked about retaining information in the database, this is where you're diving in. Familiarity is habit. So therefore, whenever the familiarity comes in and you know exactly how to respond to an experience, that is the aggregate of formation taking place. Now here, fifth aggregate is then said to be the element of consciousness. And therefore, consciousness is the very sort of important or the indispensable element in the production of the experiences. When physical factors such as the senses and the sense objects meet, by themselves, they cannot create an experience. The sense eyes and the form, for them to be able to make sense, a bridge has to be made between the sense and the sense objects. Whatever bridges the gap between the sense and the sense objects is called the consciousness. So the eye, when it sees the form, the recognition is the eye consciousness. When the ears hear a sound, the hearing is the hearing consciousness. When the mouth gets a taste and it feels the tasting, one who experiences the tasting, is the tongue consciousness. Likewise, when the nose and the fragrance meet and you smell it, that's the smell consciousness. Body, when it feels the texture or the temperature, you feel warm, you feel cold, when the sense body and the object both meet together, and makes recognition of it. That's the textual consciousness, body consciousness. Mind and the thought, when it articulates the thought, that is the mental consciousness. For a meditator to be aware, acutely aware of these aggregates are important. Why so? Is because that's what you call yourself. Who am I? When you ask the question, this is who we are. Some totality of what we have so simply called me or I is nothing but the buildup of all these aggregates. So like a very well-oiled machine, all the aggregates function all the time. And so hurriedly, since we have no time and everything has to be sort of condensed into a very quick conclusion, we refer to it as me or I. But for a meditator to truly allow the mind to understand a much more bigger perspective of the bigger picture. Why so? Is because you blame the I so much for everything. You praise the I too much also often. And therefore, since a lot of the problems seem to be coming from the praise or the blame of the I, it becomes necessary to educate oneself to being able to see what does create this I. Who is this I? Who is this me that I think I am? Beyond just the letters of ME or I, the English alphabet, what is the nature is nothing but the five aggregates. Here it says the fifth, consciousness aggregate, and the fourth aggregate, formation. Both of them produces only an awareness. If only the fourth and the fifth aggregates are looked at, formation and consciousness, it's nothing but a mere awareness. They by themselves cannot produce any kind of a dualistic concept or aggravation of any kind. But the first three, form, feeling, and perception, changes the awareness into personal experience. So when we talk about meditating, we talk about settling the consciousness, settling the mind, settling everything that is coming into formation by not grasping to it. So where does the whole idea of don't grasp come? It's because formation is not being allowed to then create a personal experience. Stilling the mind in mindfulness comes where you're training what is a very alert consciousness. You cannot say, you know, you cannot cut your ears and say, this is the problem, I'm not going to hear anything more. You cut your nose and you put it over here and you say, I'm not going to do it anymore. When meditators try to eliminate mind from meditation, then this is what they do. They try to block everything. But you can't do that. Consciousness is brilliant. It is going to see things. It is going to think things. It is going to feel things. But at the same time, that can be tamed. Its brilliance can be tamed. Its brilliance should not be destroyed. Taming the brilliance of the consciousness's own sort of vivacious nature, awakened nature, however, can come when you don't embroil everything into a personal, my form, my feelings, my perceptions. Personal experiences is when you allow the grasping to it become so strong that you make everything yours. So what is an awakened, vivacious nature becomes my feeling, my idea, my form. Forms are not allowed to be forms. It becomes my forms, your forms, our forms. That's why when simple things as, you leave the room today for lunch and you come back and you find on this cushion that you thought was yours, somebody else has placed a scarf. First thing you do is, whose scarf is this? Put it in your seat. This is mine. So forms become a personal thing. Feelings become a personal thing. Perceptions become a personal thing. You begin to own them. You begin to possess them. You begin to assert your own ownership on certain things. And that's the breaking of the two, self and others, duality arises. And so seeing it in this way, one begins to see how the aggregates are the nature of all phenomena. We are aggregates. The outer phenomena is aggregate. Beyond the aggregates, what is the reality of any outer phenomena or inner phenomena? The body is made up of aggregates. The outer phenomena is made up of aggregates. Everything is aggregates, but we do not appreciate that because we personalize. We allow the experiences of the aggregates to become so personal that we attach ourselves to it. And that is where what is the natural nature is not seen, but is immediately hijacked by the ego grasping tendencies. Where that happens, then everything becomes more solidified. Where solidification happens, from the fourth nidana onwards, there's not much control at all. So up until the level of the ignorance, the formation, the consciousness, and the name and the form, you have some amount of control to not swing this way, but to create the equilibrium and the awareness of the things as they truly are. But once the formation of the name and the form comes into being, you've begun to name things, you've begun to create forms to ideas, you've begun to project your own ownership on aggregates as yourself or as the others, the birth of duality takes place. Then the seed of karma has been spun, so to speak. You can't spin something and then keep shouting, stop, stop. It keeps on spinning, and kind of an uncontrolled state of creation manifests. That is then called cyclic existence. So things just come into production. So here, where we talk about mindfulness and meditation, training the mind to be mindful, is trying to allow ourselves to working more skillfully with the aggregates, so that one sees the true nature of forms, one sees the true nature of feelings, one sees the true nature of perceptions, the true nature of formation, true nature of consciousness. When the true nature of the five aggregates are seen, a sense of relaxed approach to things as they arise begins to be more clearly understood, creating the mental equilibrium called the state of samadhi or equanimity. That is called meditation.